Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks so much for joining us for our show today. We're glad to have you all here. Of course, as usual, if you want to see us on the air, you can go to Facebook, go to the GPB news page, and you can watch our Facebook live feed. We love it when you leave comments about the show there. And, of course, if you want to tweet us, we're at PoliticsGPB. Let's get right to our show today, though, because it's a good one. We are really thrilled to have with us the 73rd Speaker of the Georgia House of Representatives, David Ralston. David, you, Mr. Speaker, you've been Speaker since, what, 2010?
Correct.
Blue Ridge is your home base. Represent, what is it, House District 7?
That's right.
Up there, which takes in, what's the territory up there?
It's all of Fannin County, all of Gilmer County, and a western slice of Dawson County around Amicola Falls, Big Canoe part of Dawson County.
You grew up really in Ellijay, though.
Did.
Went to Gilmer County High School and Young Harris College. Have I got that right so far?
You have.
And North Georgia College, and you got your law degree at the University of Georgia.
Correct.
Okay, I just want to make sure I got those credentials right. Jim Galloway's
We never had that many speakers from North Georgia, did we?
Never had one.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Is that right? Are you the first speaker from up that way?
I am the two most northernmost speakers were Speaker Murphy from Bremen and Speaker Dick Russell from Winder.
Wow.
And from that, you can draw a line from one of those towns to the other, and north of that line, there's never been a speaker before.
Well, we're glad that you are here with us today. We know you have a really important and probably eventful session coming up. We're going to swear in a brand new governor on Monday, the same day that you gavel the House to order for the session. Before we talk about things coming up, Jim Galloway, I want to start with some news that Tom Faust, our senior producer, just shared with me. Apparently, you all at the AJC just reported that Governor Deal has a new job that he announced.
Yeah, he's going to be Professor Deal.
Teaching at the University of Georgia.
At the University of Georgia, which is the School of Law, I think, there, and which is a little bit, that's interesting. I think he got his degree from Mercer.
He did.
They
grabbed him.
3 years, $120,000 salary a year.
So that gives us an opportunity to just, for a couple minutes, Mr. Speaker, tell us about the legacy of Nathan Deal. Leaves office as one of the most popular, bipartisan popular governors in the state of Georgia. Why is that?
I think it was not just his accomplishments, but his governing style. I tell people every day, many times every day, that we're going to miss this governor. He has done a tremendous job steering the ship of state through times, particularly early in his administration, when the financial picture was very lean here. And, but he focused on doing some things, and you go back to preserving the Hope Scholarship Program, helping us on the fight on transportation funding, criminal justice reform, an amazing landmark for him to leave, helping create a climate for business here in the state that has resulted in unprecedented job growth. I think over 700,000 new jobs in the private sector. A lot of states are very envious of our record here, but I think it's more than the things he accomplished. I think it was the manner in which he governed. He's a very collaborative governor. We had, I think we were able to get a lot of things done because he obviously had very strong views on many issues, but he also would listen to opposing viewpoints, and he respected those, he respected those who might take issue with his viewpoint. So that kind of style, I think, really endeared him to many members of the General Assembly and people who had an opportunity to observe state government up close.
On that point, Mr. Speaker, one of the things that I think Governor Deal did that was unique was that he kind of understood the link between economic development and these great cultural debates that we've had. And he came down on this side or on that side of them, but he always made sure that cultural debate didn't dominate the situation.
Talking about, say, religious liberty.
Religious liberty, even guns on campuses.
Campus carry.
So I guess one question is that a lesson that will stick?
Well, I hope so. I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, everyone that goes into that office has their own viewpoints and their own place that they will come down on that. So I'm optimistic that it will. I think that he did not belittle those cultural issues, but it was, as you said, it was more of a they were confined to one place, and then the economic development issues were separated out, and I think the state is better for that. And if you need proof of that, you can look at some of our neighbor states, North Carolina and Arkansas and Indiana, as governor or the vice president would probably agree. He did manage to do that in a very, very productive and positive way.
Let's do this. We're going to get into a little bit about Brian Kemp, some of the things that he ran on, the issues that he ran on, and talk to you about which of those you think are likely to actually come up in this session of the General Assembly. But before we get to that, as regular listeners to our show know, Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, the Democrat, was on the show yesterday. And just as we were about to go on the air, she got the email that you sent out to all of your members announcing you had created a special committee that is going to continue the work on rural health care that you had a special task force looking at for quite some time. And when we saw your email, we all wondered just how broad the mandate was going to be in terms of whether this was going to be just about rural health care. Could it be statewide? Could it include Medicaid? So let's just listen to a brief portion of yesterday and then talk to you about it now.
I have been fairly discouraged. That's a mild word for how I felt about the Republican leadership failure to use the opportunity to take, without any obligation, $9 million a day for Medicaid expansion. And the discussion has always been, well, we're going to do something. And I've been very, very reluctant to believe that. But this email, because it comes from the most stable leader, the one we know in the Capitol, the Speaker, gives me some hope.
I love Mary Margaret Oliver. She knows how to wrap a slightly, thorny message with a love letter to you. Help us understand what the mandate of this committee, which you've appointed Sharon Cooper of Cobb County as co-chair of, what are you going to do with that?
Well, I prefer to look at the love letter part of, of our message. And I do. I have to. Greatest respect and love for Mary Margaret. She and I admire her, and she's one of the most decent and honorable people I know. We've served in state government together now for a number of years, and she really is a class person. She's just wrong on this issue, as she often is, that I tell her. The decision to do this was a decision that I kind of I've wrestled with for many, many months now. If you look at the history of this issue, and I'm specifically, I guess, the larger issue or most prominent part of this, the work of this committee is likely to be the certificate of need discussion. This is something, you know, we've had bills introduced and we've kind of danced around and we've had rhetoric about it for a long time, but it's never really has in my view at least, has gotten the kind of attention and real debate and real analysis that it deserved and that Georgians need to have before we make a decision on what we do about this. I mean, there are some powerful interests lined up on one side or the other of this issue, but the interest that needs to be safeguarded is that of patients and consumers of health care in Georgia. And it's time we put them back in the focus here, and so I'm hoping that that will be prominent on the minds of the members of the committee. So I thought it was important to have some fresh eyes and some eyes that had seen the issue from work on the Rural Development Council. And really, it was people that I thought had a strong interest in the issue, and I really wasn't trying to play a geographic area against geographic area on this, because I think it's a statewide issue.
Jim, so it sounds like Medicaid, but expansion of Medicaid, which is of course what Mary Margaret was getting at here, is may not be happening.
Let's frame that question. Okay, first of all, let's define for listeners. Let's define a certificate of need. It's kind of a 40-year program that Georgia has used to limit competition among hospitals and other healthcare providers in order, theoretically, to lower cost. I mean, there's a lot of debate over whether that has actually worked here. Mr. Speaker, is there a potential bargain on the table? Because the hospitals of Georgia, especially in the rural areas, they want to see some sort of Medicaid waiver or expansion. The legislature has been struggling with the CON issue for years, for decades. It's not much liked. Is there one for the other?
Possibility? I don't know. I don't view it as one for the other at all. I think that you can these can stand alone as issues. You know, my record or my position on Medicaid expansion is clear. I don't view that as a sustainable solution here in Georgia. I've gotten cautionary tales from other states of whose leaders I've discussed this with. I have read the governor-elect has some interest in perhaps Medicaid waivers. I have not seen any detail on that, so I'm not sure exactly what his proposal would be, but certainly as the governor-elect, he's entitled to have that considered by the General Assembly, and we would consider it.
I apologize for interrupting. My understanding, based on some of his comments on the campaign trail, is that what he talked about with waivers is there a way that the legislature, that the state can get a waiver from the feds that would allow for funds to supplement the cost of insurance in Georgia. Is that basically what you understand it to be as well?
It is, and I think there's also been some discussion about a work requirement in that waiver, and certainly that would be something I think that would merit discussion.
The issue, Jim, becomes If you're talking about supplementing insurance costs, that isn't helping expand coverage to the neediest Georgians necessarily.
No, but it is. It's you're reaching a population that isn't reflexively signing up for ACA or anything like that. If we're talking about stabilizing premiums on the ACA, is that one reason why Richard Smith, you named Richard Smith chairman? I mean, he's chairman of the House Insurance Committee.
No, that really wasn't why I named him. I named him because I don't know that there's anyone whose integrity is more beyond reproach in the House than Richard Smith. He's an honorable man. He's stubborn as he can be. But he's smart, and he will drill down into this issue in a very, very intense way. But yet he will be fair to both sides, and he doesn't bring a history on the issue to the table. That was why I selected him to chair it.
Yeah. You've got four Democrats on there. It's a 15-member panel. You've got four Democrats. One of them is Calvin Smyrie. And whenever a Republican thinks that he might need Republican or Democratic votes, you kind of suddenly see Smyrie at the table there. Am I reading that right?
Well, he would love hearing you say that. I hope he's listening. Calvin's very, very respected. I mean, he's at a point in his legislative career where he kind of transcends party, or at least in my view, he does.
Longest-serving member of the General Assembly.
He is, so he just brings a great deal of maturity and wisdom to whatever issue it is, and he's been a great ally on. Whether on transportation funding and on transit, so I felt like that his experience would be very, very beneficial to the work of this. And I named other Democrats to it too because I think it's important to be bipartisan.
Let me, if I could, move to a subject that played a big role, I think it's fair to say, in the gubernatorial campaign, Brian Kemp. Announced that he was looking at a $5,000 raise for K-12 teachers in Georgia, and a $700 million nut that brings along with it, something in that neighborhood, I think. You have been, I think, when you were asked about that, you sounded a cautious note in terms of the funding for that, but it was interesting that yesterday, again, with Ed Lindsay, a former legislator, Republican, and Mary Margaret, the Democrat sitting here, they both said, well, this is something the legislature could probably come together and work on. I don't know about that. Could you imagine implementing that, only having to do it over a period of years instead of sessions rather than all at once?
Well, what's kind of gotten lost in this discussion is the fact that under Nathan Deal, we have taken huge strides in making teacher compensation more competitive in Georgia. So I think we have to start at that point. Then we look at, how do we fund it? I mean, as you mentioned, it's a big ticket item. The budget people in the House that I've been talking to tell me that the natural growth of Medicaid, leaving aside, any changes in the program, the natural growth is going to exceed $200 million in the next budget. So that you have that ticket. You have, I'm not sure that we're finished with what we need to do to help Southwest Georgia on the hurricane relief. And so we're going to have to go back and take a look at that, and that would, if there are unmet needs that the state needs to meet, now is the time to do that there, and we'll have to determine what that might be. We're going to take a look at it. It's a lot of money, I'm not sure I do applaud the governor-elect for making this issue front and center. That tells me that he's going to make education a real priority in his administration, and I think he's to be commended for that.
I'm sure we'll get to other topics
in a bit, Bill.
I was going to give the speaker first crack at it. What's the one thing we haven't been talking about? I mean, in our conversations, even that came up at the biennial in December. What are we not talking about that you see as the surprise issue of the session? There's always one.
There's always one, but it never comes along until the session gets going. I don't know, Jim. We've talked about some of the issues that are out there. The budget's obviously going to be important, and I think people are really interested in this budget because it'll be the first Kemp budget. Mm-hmm. And it will sort of reflect what his priorities are going to be.
Let me toss out. Okay. Concealed carry without a permit.
An issue that Brian Kemp talked about on the campaign trail.
Well, he and I may not agree on everything. We have taken some big steps to strengthen the protections of Georgians under the Second Amendment. And I'm very proud of those. The bill we passed in 2014 Representative Rick Jaspers and Representative Mandy Ballinger led the charge on to expand the places that if you had a permit you could carry, I think was a very, very good bill. Campus carry, frankly, I think was a good bill that we passed in 2016 or 17. I don't know. I don't know what the appetite's going to be for that kind of legislation in the House, I'm going to take a very, very cautious view.
Well, let me ask a question, sort of based on that. You certainly know that Metro Atlanta has turned bluer than it's been in a long time. Along that northern arc there, Cobb County, Gwinnett County, both turning more and more blue. Cobb County elects a Democrat to the United States House. And Brian Kemp did not do particularly well in Metro, obviously did well in rural for the most part. To what extent do you as a political leader now have to look at the kind of legislation that comes forward in this session as you similarly try to make sure that those areas don't slip even further from Republican grasp? And certainly things like not having a permit for a weapon, religious liberty, there are any number of measures that could hurt Republicans even more conceivably if they get a lot of attention this session.
Well, I think I do have some responsibility there, and I take it very seriously. I think that Georgians expect us to govern in a very responsible way and in a very productive way. I don't really run out and do polls on all these issues.
Leave that to us.
I'll let y'all do the polls, but I do talk to people, I do know the concerns. I've talked with many of the candidates that we had some very, very good candidates who came up short in November in the metro area, and I've talked with most all of those, and I know their views on these issues and what kind of role it may have played. But I also talk to people in the area I live in. And I frequently tell people, and I say this proudly, I probably have more gun racks in the back of pickup trucks in my county than any other county in Georgia. So this is not exactly a a county that's ready to disarm, okay? I have had two people in my 20-plus years, ever how long I've been here, I've had two individuals mention to me that they thought they ought to be able to carry without a permit. I wonder how much of this issue is being ginned up by an extreme fringe special interest group that is looking obviously to raise funds and do all the things that these groups do. I think we've had one bill dropped in the House, but I've had many House members express to me their concern that we'll even take it up. So I'll leave it there.
What will be your message when the House Republican Caucus gets together about how y'all go about selecting issues that you're going to live and die by during this session?
Well, I think we have to focus on what we're doing. We focus on the fact we actually talk about things that we talked about that we did last year that got drowned out by some of these other issues in the election cycle.
The decrease in income tax.
Yeah, we cut income tax. We fully funded QBE. We put state funds into school safety plans. We did adoption reform. I mean, it was an amazing session in terms of accomplishment and positive things that we could go out and run on. And then we have, the one or two issues that come along and kind of drown that. And that is hurtful. And I think we've got to be very, very careful in what we do and maybe do less of that kind of thing.
Well, you also had President Trump sucking all the oxygen out of the local and state political atmosphere. I mean, very difficult, it seems to me. You mentioned all those accomplishments, but it's very difficult with the loud voice of President Trump to get too far past him when you want to try to deal with the local issues that matter to you, isn't it?
Well, the president is a, I guess dichotomy is the word, for however unpopular he may be in metro areas, he is at least that popular, if not more so, in rural Georgia.
Sure. I mean, Brian Kemp proves that.
I mean, point made.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he carried my district 2 years ago with 82% of the vote. I was kind of happy. I beat him, though, up there this past November. I got 84-85%. I think it's how, we have to understand if you are a strong supporter of the president, that there are not everybody in Georgia agrees with you. And by the same token, if you just detest this president and you think he ought not be in office, not every person in Georgia agrees with you.
I know your time is limited here, so let me get something in before we have to lose you. And that is we've got a federal shutdown that is moving into its third week. Pretty quickly, I think David Perdue was on the on
Bloomberg News.
On Bloomberg News and said it could last a couple more weeks. We haven't, for logistical reasons, I'm sure we haven't heard from Brian Kemp on what effect this is having on the state budget. And of course, Nathan Deal at this point is deferring to him. But I mean, can you give us any kind of reading on what the impact thus far has been on state finances and operations, and what you're watching to make sure when you'll push the red button to panic?
Well, I think that the areas of government that are shut down are areas that I hate to say that they could probably, you know, it's not the military and opera.
You do have a lot of federal parks in your area.
Yeah, we do have parks, and we got the world's busiest airport out here, and so you have TSA and all the operations. Some of those are federal in nature, and so we'll be keeping an eye on the airport and the parks. You know, the parks, obviously, I mean, we're all this, you know, we all want this to end and be resolved. This is really not a way to operate a government. I'm thankful we don't operate here in Georgia that way.
Let me, with the limited time we have, ask you about another issue that gained probably far more national attention than you would certainly have wished it had, and that's questions about the integrity of Georgia's election. We've said on this show any number of times that the national media, I think, has painted a darker picture of how elections are operated here in Georgia. I've said that Brian Kemp may have contributed to that by not recusing himself from overseeing the elections. But whatever. The point is, right now, you know this, nationally, there are people looking at Georgia with great skepticism. You're going to get a number of election reform bills in this session. There are going to be some efforts probably to eliminate exact match. There may be some efforts to standardize how elections are run across the state. Do you believe that we're at a point where Georgia needs a major reform in how we run our elections, or are there selective areas that you're most concerned about?
I don't think we're at a point where we need a major reform of our election laws. I think our election laws are basically sound. I think we have to always monitor our technology to make sure that it's state of the art and it's current. I do know that the Secretary of State's SAFE Commission is going to issue its report tomorrow, I think. And so we'll have that for our consideration.
That dealing with how we vote in 2020 and beyond, what kind of apparatus right. We use to vote.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll be monitoring that. But no, I think we did take a fair, an unfair hit over some of these practices, and you know, stories about election shenanigans. I mean, are part of the culture all over Georgia and all over the South, I guess, for that matter.
And I'm in from other Chicago, areas. Mr. Speaker.
Oh well, we try to mimic you, and we're not successful.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So I mean, you have these kind of things, but I mean, in terms of the governor-elect not resigning or recusing himself, I mean, he conducted himself as every Secretary of State that had run for another office had for Kathy Cox, going back to her and some of the others.
I think Kathy recused herself during her run for governor from overseeing the election itself. But go ahead.
I'll check that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was and so much of this is dealt with at the local level. So the Secretary of State's more sort of a information warehouse, if you will, as opposed to, calling balls and strikes.
Yeah. Yeah. But you did raise an interesting point. It does feel as though not just that on one hand, Georgians want to be reassured that their election is run with integrity and their votes are counted accurately. You know that. And there are some concerns about that probably right now. And then as far as the national image goes, I think you're also right. National reporters looked and said they didn't understand that a county has control over its way it runs its elections. And so they looked and blamed it all on the state. Nevertheless, there's some reputation repair that has got to be done. You want to keep attracting business to Georgia. You want the state to be thought of in positive ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we always have to do that which we need to do to keep an economic climate the way you want it to. But I think you have to recognize too that there are some in the national media and other places that. You know, they're never going to accept the truth or accept the reality, whether it's good, bad, or in between.
Do you have any preference as to what kind of next generation voting machine we should be going after, whether OptiScan with a real paper ballot or something more modified?
Yeah, I'm not technologically savvy enough to get down into the details of what I would prefer. I think the absolute worst case that we could do is to go back to a paper ballot. And I know some in the other party want to do that. I'm open to talking about a paper backup, but I think we continue to use the technology that we have that's evolving and advancing. If it's good enough in business and medicine and other parts of our lives, then certainly it ought to be good enough to have a fair election.
Speaker Ralston, you've been really generous with your time. We've kept you a little longer than we said we would, and we're grateful to you for coming in. We wish you well on this upcoming session of the legislature. It should be, we're really looking forward to watching how you all work with the new governor of the state, taking on some of the crucial issues that we face in this session. So again, thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's been great to have you here.
Thank you, Bill and Jim.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. And Speaker Ralston has got to get back downtown, and we'll come back, Galloway and I, and we'll have some comments to make as we move toward the end of the show.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Who are the people whose names you see at the end of a movie or a TV show? I'm Kalina Bowler. I've worked for years behind the scenes in Georgia's booming film industry. In my GPB podcast, I meet the people who help bring art to life, from actors to stuntmen to camera operators. Join me for the credits. Subscribe at thecreditspodcast.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Rachel Maddow and Mike Yarvitz talk about their podcast, Bagman, about the bribery and extortion scandal that led Nixon's first vice president, Spiro Agnew, to be forced out of office. The podcast reveals some new twists in that story. It's a story that has important parallels and lessons that relate to the current investigations into President Trump. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
My name is Dana Brown. I am the program manager at the Georgia Adoption Reunion Registry. Our goal is to help persons impacted by adoption experience healthy reconnections to impact healthy well-being. We underwrite with GPB because of your extensive listening audience that covers the state of Georgia. It's an effective way to get the word out about what we do across the state of Georgia.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Speaker David Ralston made his way out of the studio a second ago. He's got a lot to do downtown getting set for this upcoming session of the Georgia General Assembly. Before Jim and I continue our conversation, let me remind you all that on Monday, we've got some special programming for you. We're going to do a special inaugural edition of Political Rewind on Monday at 1 o'clock, and it'll be on both radio and TV. It'll also be on Facebook. It will be on Facebook Live, won't it, Tom Faust? Yes. And then at 2 o'clock, we're going to present the entire inaugural ceremony. It'll be, Jim, you'll be with us, thank goodness. We'll be over at Georgia Tech where this thing is unfolding. Loretta Lepore is going to be with us, and Dr. Andre Gillespie. So we'll all have a chance to talk before the inaugural, and then we'll get to fill in here and there when the inauguration ceremony is underway.
We'll have to dress up. We'll have to wear ties.
I know. I know. I'm afraid you're right. Jim, you know, I think one of the things that every time we talk to David Ralston, whether it's you separately, me separately, together like this, I think it's fair to say that on both sides of the aisle, even though not everyone agrees with him, and Democrats have a lot of issues with some of the things that Ralston does, we see here again, this is a guy who thinks through. He's thoughtful. He's moderate in his approach. You're never going to get David Ralston hanging out there on the edge, taking up the kind of social, the kind of crazy issues that cause so much disruption in our political process.
Well, you've got to remember how he came to be Speaker, and that was you had the Republicans take over the House, I think in 2004, mm-hmm. in 2005,
right.
when they were swearing in, the Glenn Richardson was kind of a Newt Gingrich type. He was a bomb thrower, and wanted to make many many ideological points. Things didn't work out. His speakership collapsed. Ralston was brought in to bring stability to a very, very rocky House, and he's done that over the years. And it might get a little bit harder for him today this year because he's lost we talked about these 11 Republicans that he lost in his chamber. Most of them were in Metro Atlanta, which means they were a little bit more moderate, a little bit more business oriented than the rural lawmakers, and that voice is going to be missing from his caucus now.
I think if there is an issue that if you were to poll Democratic members and Democrats probably in a larger way across the state, it may be, tell me what you think about this, if there's one area where they wish they could move Ralston, I mean, he's great on religious liberty to them. He's already held the line on that. He introduced his Pastor Protection Act as a way to stave off the people who wanted religious liberty bill. It's on Medicaid expansion. It strikes me that continues to be one of the most difficult issues for Republicans and Democrats to reconcile down at the Capitol.
Right, right. He and Nathan Deal are very, very much on the same page in that they are not convinced of the federal government is a longtime reliable partner in this, and that's what's causing a lot of the angst, especially in rural areas. The crux, though, is that you can't get economic development to an area that's vastly underemployed unless you have health care.
Yeah, the other area where I think it's going to be interesting to see how Republicans and Democrats interact during the session is my guess is that Democrats are going to be much more eager for more significant and major election reform measures. Mary Margaret Oliver yesterday on the show said she really wants to see legislation introduced that would eliminate exact match, which was by far one of the most contentious issues during the entire election campaign.
But you're on the Republican side, you're going to see some efforts to kind of push
yes.
their issues. You might see an attempt to curtail early voting.
Yep.
You might have the exact match process that you were talking about is more policy. There may be a push than statute that you may see an effort to put that into statute.
Right.
And quite frankly, you're probably going to see a lot of little tweaks to how House districts are drawn. In order to shore up a few members here and there.
So do you imagine that we're going to see a bill introduced that will maybe redraw some districts where Democrats made gains in Gwinnett County and the like.
I think so.
A run out of territory at a certain point.
Oh yeah, yeah. At a certain point, you do. But you'll recall this was the one area where Democrat Stacey Abrams got a lot of criticism because I think it was a 2016 bill that she and her people didn't pay enough attention to, that probably cost them a seat or two down in Henry County.
Yep, redrew it, some district lines that allowed Republicans to hold on to safe seats down there, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you asked him if there was a surprise in the session that he, you know, maybe, is there an issue that's going to come up that maybe we're all going to be surprised by? Did you have something in the back of your mind on that?
No, but I hope our listeners realize that we did make a little news here. You had the Speaker of the House saying, drawing the line on gun legislation,
yep.
It's basically saying that he did not want to see any legislation that it would allow concealed weaponry to be carried without a permit.
Yep. I was interested in that, and I can't help but wonder how Governor Kemp will take on that issue. He talked about it on the campaign trail. And it's all part of that larger question we're all going to be watching, which is how will Brian Kemp govern? Does he govern as a guy playing to his base, or is he going to have to move to the center a bit? And that's one of the issues that will give us an indication on how he's going to govern.
Yeah, his inaugural speech is going to be very, very closely watched.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on. The session starts on Monday, and we'll watch that unfold. Excuse me. Let's talk just a little bit about Georgia and the president's speech last night. It was interesting to me that, among other things, in his Oval Office address, the governor actually cited a Clayton County murder, a really heinous and grisly murder of a 76-year-old man down in Clayton County killed by allegedly an undocumented immigrant, all part of the president's effort to make the case for why we need to keep people from entering the country.
Yeah,
illegally.
This is Robert Page. He's a 76-year-old grandfather. He was, I think, murdered with a hammer by Christian Ponce Martinez. I think the fact that he was undocumented was a little bit of news that the president broke last night. I'm not sure that we were aware of that. It's been talked about here locally because in the aftermath of the murder,
he was dismembered.
He was beheaded.
Yes.
The victim was beheaded. And we had a couple of GBI employees resign when they photographed themselves with the head. So that's what that murder has been mostly known for.
So reaction from the Georgia delegation was completely what you'd expect it to be. The Republicans pretty much towed the line and said they support the president on this. David Perdue, once again, proving he is one of the most staunch and fiercest allies of the president when it comes to the president's policies. Yeah.
But you know, if you listen very closely to that interview that he gave on Bloomberg, there were a couple of things that were interesting. On the more disturbing side was that he said that this could go on for another couple of weeks,
yeah.
which you know you've got a bunch of workers out there, as the speaker mentioned, who that's going to be hard for them to take. But on the other hand, Perdue also said it was time for the Senate to take a greater role in the negotiations. And that's what's been missing.
And that's pressure on
Mitch McConnell.
Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has simply refused to get involved. There's all sorts of speculation as to why he thought he had a deal with the president that he could bring back to the Senate, get a vote on to keep the government open, give limited funds. The president then backed out of it. The speculation is that McConnell felt that he'd been wronged and embarrassed and so was trying to stay out of it. But more and more Republican senators like a Perdue coming forward and starting to edge towards saying, you can't stay on the sidelines, Mitch.
Yeah, I've counted three Republicans in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate now, who are saying it's time to get the government back to work. I think
Murkowski is now kind of moving in that direction.
Susan Collins
is moving in that direction.
Is it Cory Gardner?
Cory Gardner of Colorado. They all have, because they have, Cory Gardner, of course, has got a a race coming up in 2020. But, you know, Perdue said something else. He took advantage of the shutdown to talk about something that's been a theme of his virtually since the day he took office, which is, and you can't say he's wrong, saying the way we pass spending measures in Congress is a little bit nuts. Here's what he said on Bloomberg.
We're in the fourth month of this fiscal year that we're talking about. And the second fact is, because we stayed here in August last year in the Senate, we actually funded 75% of the discretionary budget. Now, as outrageous as that is, that's the first time in 22 years that that even got done, David. So this just smacks of the dysfunction here in the whole funding process of our discretionary budget.
Two things about that. Number one, as a business leader, as a corporate CEO, you can imagine that the way they fund government drives him crazy. You can't really fault him for that. And of course, he talks with some pride about their staying in session in August. It was David Perdue who took the lead on saying, why do you think we should all get to go home, go on vacation? There's work to be done.
Right. And so if you have somebody like David Perdue saying it's time to time to force the issue here and try to bring a resolution to it, that indicates something. Yeah. It really does, I think.
It reminds me, and we talked about this on the show yesterday, and we'll certainly be talking about it for weeks and months to come as we approach the 2020 election cycle. David Perdue has staked his political future on being aligned with President Trump come hell or high water.
And it's going to be interesting. This week, maybe since we last talked, Stacey Abrams has said she's going to give herself until March, the end of March, I think, to make a call on this. You've already got a number of people waiting. I don't know if they can wait that long.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. We've got very little time left, but I was struck by that, too. Waiting until March. I get that Stacey Abrams ran such a strong campaign. She did so. She really deserves the Democrats' respect at this point. But yeah, March, that's a long time to keep others on the sidelines or to put them in a position of having to jump in only to find out that she is going to be there as an opponent.
Right, right. And her advantage, of course, is she's got a financial network yeah. already established. And the others would certainly have to crank it up.
So much, you know, have you noticed there's no such thing as a downtime in politics anymore, and especially in the election process?
Oh, tell me about it. Yeah, yeah.
All right. We're out of time for today's Political Rewind. Jim, thank you so much for being here. This is kind of an off day for you, and you came in to be part of this conversation.
Oh, no. With
the speaker.
With the speaker, you can't miss that.
Yeah, we enjoyed having you here. We'll be back on Friday at 2 o'clock with another live show. And by the way, it's Friday night at 7. It's this Friday night that Political Rewind will now be on our TV side, on our PBS stations across the state. So if you don't hear the show on Friday afternoon, you can watch what we talk about on Friday night at 7. And Jim Galloway will be with us for that show. Jim, again, thanks for being here. Thanks to you all for listening. See you again Friday afternoon.